Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we look at new studies on high-dose influenza vaccines for older adults, antiplatelet therapy after coronary surgery, and HER2-targeted immunotherapy for advanced bladder cancer. We review complex regional pain syndrome and a pediatric case of fever and rash. We also explore FDA innovation and safety, aspirin's role in metastasis prevention, and the meaning of the good doctor, smallpox in the revolution, and how AI may reshape medical science. High-dose influenza vaccine effectiveness against hospitalization in older adults by Niklas Derby Johansen from the Copenhagen University Hospital, Herlev and Gentofte, Denmark, and co-authors. Newer influenza vaccines have been developed to provide increased protection in older adults, including the high-dose inactivated influenza vaccine, which contains four times the amount of hemagglutinin contained in standard-dose inactivated influenza vaccines. In a previous double-blind trial, high-dose inactivated influenza vaccine was shown to provide protection against influenza that is superior to that with the standard dose. However, data from individually randomized trials on the effectiveness of the high-dose vaccine against severe outcomes are limited. In this trial in Denmark, during the 2022 to 2025 influenza seasons, more than 300,000 older adults, 65 years of age or older, were randomly assigned to receive the high dose of the inactivated influenza vaccine or the standard dose. The primary endpoint was hospitalization for influenza or pneumonia that occurred from 14 days after vaccination through May 31 of the following year. A primary endpoint event occurred in 0.68% of participants in the high-dose group and in 0.73% of those in the standard-dose group, for a relative vaccine effectiveness of 5.9%. which was not a significantly lower incidence of hospitalization for influenza or pneumonia than a standard dose among older adults. High-dose influenza vaccine to reduce hospitalizations by Jacobo Pardo Secco from the Instituto de Investigación Sanitaria de Santiago, Santiago de Compostela, Spain, and co-authors. This trial evaluated the relative effectiveness of high-dose inactivated influenza vaccine as compared with the standard dose against severe clinical outcomes among more than 103,000 community-dwelling adults 65 to 79 years of age. The trial was performed during two influenza seasons, 2023 to 2024 and 2024 to 2025, with regional health registry data in Galicia, Spain. In each influenza season, the participants were randomly assigned to receive the high-dose inactivated influenza vaccine or the standard dose. The primary endpoint was a composite of hospitalization for influenza or pneumonia from 14 days after vaccination to May 31 of the following year. Recipients of the high-dose vaccine appeared to have a 23.7% lower risk of hospitalization for influenza or pneumonia as compared with the standard dose group. Kathleen Neusel from the Gates Foundation, Seattle, writes in an editorial that although the participants who received high-dose vaccine had fewer hospitalizations for pneumonia or influenza than those who received standard-dose vaccine in both of these trials, the magnitude of the effect varied and only reached statistical significance in the trial by Pardo Secco and co-authors. Prevention of the severe effect of influenza infection in the high-risk older adult population is a public health priority. The results of these two trials are consistent with previous data showing incremental benefit of the high-dose vaccine and support the recommendation in the United States that higher-dose or adjuvanted influenza vaccines are preferred over standard-dose vaccines for adults 65 years of age or older. Healthcare providers and staff at alternative vaccination sites who serve this population should ensure adequate supply of these enhanced influenza vaccines. However, if only standard dose vaccine is available, it should be given. In countries that do not yet use high-dose vaccine, these trials provide additional evidence of its benefit for policymakers. Ticagrelor and aspirin, or aspirin alone, after coronary surgery for acute coronary syndrome. By Anders Jepsen, from Sahlgrenska University Hospital, Gothenburg, Sweden, and co-authors. Patients benefit from antiplatelet therapy after coronary artery bypass grafting, CABG, for an acute coronary syndrome. With the addition of ticagrelor to aspirin, as compared with aspirin alone, further reduce the risk of adverse cardiovascular outcomes. In this trial, conducted at 22 Nordic cardiothoracic surgery centers, 2,201 patients were randomly assigned to receive either ticagrelor plus aspirin or aspirin alone for 1 year after CABG for an acute coronary syndrome. Among these patients, ticagrelor plus aspirin did not result in a lower incidence of death, myocardial infarction, stroke, or repeat coronary revascularization than aspirin alone at 1 year. Disitamab vedotin plus toripalimab in HER2-expressing advanced urothelial cancer. By Xinan Sheng, from the Peking University Cancer Hospital and Institute, Beijing, and co-authors. In recent years, human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, HER2, targeted therapy has expanded to include treatment of multiple solid tumors beyond breast cancer. HER2 is also highly prevalent in urothelial carcinoma. And thus, HER2 has emerged as a potential therapeutic target in the treatment of urothelial cancer. In this Phase 3 trial in China, 484 patients with previously untreated HER2-expressing immunohistochemical score of 1+, 2+, or 3+, locally advanced or metastatic urothelial cancer, were assigned to receive either the HER2-specific disitamab vedotin plus programmed cell death protein 1 PD-1-directed immunotherapy with toripalimab every 2 weeks or standard chemotherapy every 3 weeks. Disitamab vedotin toripalimab led to significantly longer progression-free survival and overall survival than chemotherapy among these patients. Grade 3 or higher treatment-related adverse events occurred in 55.1% of patients who received disitamab vedotin plus toripalimab and 86.9% of those who received chemotherapy. In an editorial, Jens Bethke from the Klinikum Stuttgart, Germany, writes that recently the combination of the antibody-drug conjugate enfortumab vedotin, which targets Nectin-4, plus the immune checkpoint inhibitor pembrolizumab, has been established as a new standard of care for patients with urothelial carcinoma. The Phase 3 EV-302 trial showed clinically significant improvements with enfortumab plus pembrolizumab as compared with platinum-based chemotherapy in both progression-free survival and overall survival in an unselected patient population. Now, the well-designed trial by Sheng and co-authors has shown the activity of an antibody-drug conjugate combined with a PD-1 inhibitor in a pre-selected HER2-positive population. However, the side effects of disitamab vedotin plus toripalimab, increased gamma-glutamyl transferase level, hypokalemia, decreased neutrophil count, and hypoesthesia, differed from those of enfortumab plus pembrolizumab in the EV-302 trial, which may be important for future selection of patients for treatment with one of these two options. Disitamab plus toripalimab is a new combination of an antibody-drug conjugate plus immunotherapy that can be used as first-line treatment in locally advanced or metastatic urothelial carcinoma, when the current standard combination of enfortumab plus pembrolizumab is not available. Complex regional pain syndrome. A review article by Andreas Goebel from the University Hospital Aintree, Liverpool, United Kingdom. Complex regional pain syndrome, CRPS, is a rare post-traumatic chronic pain condition that affects a distal limb. Approximately 90% of cases are triggered by physical limb trauma, such as an injury, most commonly a fracture, or operation. The condition typically commences immediately to less than 1 month after the inciting event and is classified in the International Classification of Diseases, 11th revision, as a chronic primary pain disorder. The condition may be autoimmune mediated. The predominant mechanism for chronic primary pain disorders has recently been termed nociplastic pain, which denotes pain caused by a dysfunction of the peripheral nervous system, central nervous system, or both. CRPS is diagnosed according to the Budapest criteria, which require the presence of objective limb abnormalities in two of four categories: sensory, vasomotor, edema or pseudomotor, and motor or trophic. Early rehabilitation and multidisciplinary care are key. Most patients improve within 18 months. A 5-year-old boy with fever and rash. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Mitchell Feldman and colleagues. A previously healthy 5-year-old boy presented with fever, a severely pruritic rash that began on the feet and spread to the legs, buttocks, arms, and ears, and swelling of the hands and feet. He also had conjunctival injection, oral erythema, and cervical lymphadenopathy. The rash evolved into non-blanching papules with overlying excoriations, which prompted concern for vasculitis or a systemic infection. Laboratory tests showed elevated inflammatory markers, but normal platelet count and renal function. Initially evaluated for Kawasaki disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, he was treated empirically with doxycycline and prednisone. A skin biopsy confirmed leukocytoclastic vasculitis with IgA and C3 deposition, consistent with IgA vasculitis. This vasculitis is the most common pediatric small vessel vasculitis, characterized by IgA-dominant immune complex deposition, leading to non-thrombocytopenic palpable purpura, often with joint, gastrointestinal, or renal involvement. FDA's new plausible mechanism pathway. A sounding board article by Vinay Prasad and Martin Macquarie from the Food and Drug Administration, Silver Spring, Maryland. Bespoke personalized therapies challenge traditional models of drug and biologic development. The FDA's novel plausible mechanism pathway outlines a path to market entry for products where a randomized trial is not feasible. A recent case study of DNA base editing in a child with carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1 deficiency is described in this article and illustrates the tenets of the FDA's novel plausible mechanism pathway. Key features include the identification of a specific molecular or cellular abnormality, a product that targets the underlying biological alterations, and improvement in clinical outcomes or course. The FDA will reserve the use of this pathway for diseases for which the biologic cause is known and will consider previous clinical course, and, in some cases, view patients as their own control. Once manufacturers show success with several consecutive patients, the FDA will move toward granting marketing authorization. Critics may contend that there is no need for an alternative pathway, but the authors argue that the current regulations are onerous and unnecessarily demanding, and bespoke therapies are close to reality, and therefore the FDA's regulatory strategies are planned to evolve with the pace of scientific advances. Understanding how aspirin prevents metastasis, a clinical implications of basic research by Ruth Langley from the University College London and John Byrne from Newcastle upon Tyne, United Kingdom. The effects of aspirin on cancer metastasis were first recognized more than 50 years ago. In a seminal preclinical study, Gasek and colleagues found that fewer lung metastases developed in mice whose drinking water was supplemented with aspirin than in control mice. Epidemiologic data support the hypothesis that aspirin prevents cancer, but the design and interpretation of randomized trials have been hampered by a lack of mechanistic understanding. This is changing. In a recent report, Yang and colleagues describe a previously unrecognized immunosuppressive mechanism that prevents T cells from eliminating cancer metastases. At the heart of this pro-metastatic mechanism is a protein called ARGF1, which is activated by thromboxane A2, a metabolite of the platelet arachidonic acid pathway. This pathway is inhibited by aspirin through inactivation of cyclooxygenase COX enzymes. The authors note that platelet activation is key to understanding the anti-cancer effects of aspirin, which irreversibly inhibits platelet COX-1 and platelet activation. Aspirin is a low-cost generic drug, and the findings by Yang and colleagues provide an explanation for a phenomenon first reported more than 50 years ago and highlight an incentive for the redeployment of an older drug. Immeasurable excellence. What happens to medicine without the good doctor? A Medicine and Society article on the primary care puzzle by Lisa Rosenbaum, a national correspondent for the journal. Among patients who have lost their primary care physician, PCP, mortality, emergency department visits, and hospitalizations increase in the year following the PCP's exit, probably contributing to about $46,000 in additional Medicare spending for each exiting PCP. Furthermore, the frequency of adverse events in patients who have lost their PCP increases in proportion to the relationship's duration, suggesting that the relationship itself conferred health benefits. However, these benefits aren't themselves measurable. Yet, after a PCP's exit, only 23% of patients form a relationship with a new PCP. In the early 20th century, Abraham Flexner undertook his famous review of medical education. Flexner advocated for replacing the community-based practitioners serving as educators with full-time salaried faculty devoted strictly to research and training. Flexner's reforms advanced science, but in an essay describing how severing academic medical centers from their communities institutionalized a vision of the good doctor stripped of personal context, Richard Barron, who practiced primary care and geriatrics in his community for 30 years, wonders whether the Flexnerian model may have also stripped the practitioner's voice, and the community context that came with it. Rosenbaum asks, what then is our vision of the good doctor? Rosenbaum argues that we have to figure out how to be doctors in the world we have, that it's our professional responsibility to distinguish the healthcare system and its constraints from the culture every physician has a role in creating. It is time to ask, who do we, as a profession, want to be. Smallpox at the Siege of Boston, November 1775 to March 1776. A perspective by David Jones from Harvard University, Cambridge, Massachusetts. In December 1775, George Washington received intelligence about an unheard-of and diabolical scheme. Washington received intelligence from four British deserters suggesting that, quote, several persons lately inoculated with the smallpox were sent out of Boston, and one servant testified that he had been ordered, quote, to leave Boston on a crowded boat after inoculation, infecting others. Washington updated John Hancock that the British intended, quote, spreading the smallpox amongst us. Deliberate infection as an act of war was a real possibility. Smallpox played a pivotal role throughout the American Revolution, shaping both armies' strategies. However, historians have not found any documents from British officers that mention a smallpox attack. Yet, the preponderance of the data has led some to conclude that British leaders sought to spread smallpox. George Washington's vigilance helped contain smallpox at the siege, though an army sent to Canada was devastated by the disease. Smallpox played many roles in this first year of the war, its fear shaping both armies' strategies and actions. Enhancing FDA drug safety surveillance beyond releasing daily adverse event data. A perspective by Joshua Wallach from Emory University, Atlanta, and co-authors. On August 22nd, the FDA announced that it would now be releasing daily adverse event data from the FDA Adverse Event Reporting System, FAERS, replacing its previous schedule of quarterly releases. FAERS is the main database in which the agency collects information on adverse events, serious medication errors, and product quality complaints. In its announcement, the FDA stated that increasing the frequency of public data releases is part of ongoing efforts to modernize safety monitoring and facilitate more rapid identification of safety signals, aligned with its broader goal of radical transparency. But these authors write that more frequent public releases alone are unlikely to achieve the goal of improving safety surveillance. Publishing FAERS data in real time won't address key limitations such as reporting bias, duplicate or incomplete reports, and the lack of definitive data on the number of patients using a particular drug. The authors warn that frequent data releases may create perverse incentives and exacerbate the spread of misinformation. Rather than increasing release frequency, the FDA could prioritize investing in and more boldly modernizing its active post-marketing safety surveillance infrastructure. For example, enhancing the Sentinel system to generate real-world evidence, establishing clear timelines for evaluating and addressing safety signals, and publicly reporting on its progress each year would foster public trust. Bedside to Bench, AI and the New Science of Medicine. A perspective by Ziad Obermeier from the University of California, Berkeley. For centuries, doctors have tried to make sense of the body as a complex system. Today, medical research builds up an understanding of the whole from an increasingly large set of molecular parts, bench to bedside. Artificial intelligence, AI, will reinvigorate an older approach that builds down from patient-level data to theory and understanding, bedside to bench. 4 years ago, this author and his colleagues trained an AI system to re-examine the relationship between X-ray findings and pain. The algorithm they trained found new sources of pain present in X-rays and fascinating new patterns. But new facts from AI, statistical regularities in clinical data, will demand new theories to account for them. The author suggests that AI will help humans develop understanding by generating hypotheses and guiding new data collection and experimentation. For example, in their ongoing work, the author and his colleagues apply AI to predict sudden cardiac deaths, many of which could be prevented by defibrillators if they could be predicted in time. Linking ECG waveforms to death certificates from Sweden, they have trained a deep learning model that outperforms ejection fraction in predicting defibrillator benefits and is generalizable internationally. Perhaps the science of medicine is ready for reinvention, for blending new tools with old ways of thinking about the bedside, not as an endpoint for research, but as a source. In our images in clinical medicine, an 80-year-old man presented to the emergency department with a 12-hour history of pleuritic chest pain and an elevated D-dimer level. On CT, an ulcer-like projection was noted in the ascending thoracic aorta in association with an intramural hematoma that extended into the aortic arch and proximal descending aorta. Intramural hematoma is associated with a risk of aortic dissection. In another image, a 26-year-old woman presented to the emergency department with pain in her left elbow after falling on an outstretched hand while ice skating. Radiographs showed a fracture of the proximal third of the ulnar shaft and a posterior dislocation of the radial head. A diagnosis of a Monteggia fracture, a fracture dislocation injury characterized by fracture of the proximal ulna and dislocation of the radiohumeral joint, was made. This type of fracture results when a person falls on an outstretched hand with the forearm in hyperpronation. Early recognition and surgical intervention are essential to prevent chronic instability, restricted motion, and injury to the posterior interosseous nerve. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.